for Robert Redford was particularly satisfying. I flew to England a few weeks later to visit Sean on the set of The Great Train Robbery and to cement our partnership face to face. But I never asked him to sign a letter of engagement. I thought written agreements were not just overrated, because clients could void them if they went 90 days without work, but downright counterproductive. With no papers to renew, our clients had no anniversary to jog them into thinking about leaving us. We began by finding Sean a pair of prudently budgeted low-risk science fiction films. Then came something trickier, a remake of Thunderball, the vintage Bond film. Sean hadn't played Bond since Diamonds Are Forever, more than 10 years earlier, when he'd sworn off the franchise to avoid getting typecast. I felt he simply was James Bond, and that if audiences and producers were reminded of that, other opportunities would follow. One night, I worked the conversation around to Roger Moore and his shortcomings as Bond. Sean remained the definitive 007, I said, and he could not dispute me. I made sure Micheline Roquebrune, a French-born artist who is Sean's wife, supported the move, and I had Gary Hendler support the idea, too. I cleared everything client-related with Gary, behaving almost as if I were his assistant. I wore down Sean's defenses until he agreed to sip the shaken, not-stirred martini one last time. The movie's title, Never Say Never Again, came from Micheline, who recalled him telling the press that he'd never again play James Bond. Unfortunately, the shoot in the Bahamas was strained. Sean disliked the producer, and he wasn't wild about the script or the director, Irvin Kershner. Also, it had taken so long to put the film together, 4 years, that Sean was now 52, and visibly creaky in some of his action scenes. John Callie scanned the dailies in vain for the debonair Connery he'd thought he was buying. Fortunately, Sean's fans were so hungry for the real Bond that Never Say Never Again was bulletproof. And even if it stunk, I'd put together enough subsequent movies for Sean, based on his growing momentum, that he was safe. The film picked up good reviews and performed decently well at the box office. I even think Sean was glad he'd done it. He was back from the brink. Our next deal was strictly mercenary. Sean loved to make money. I told him we could take films for the payday if it was big enough, but only if we had quality projects slotted in between. Golan Globus, the Israeli producer Cousins, who had a brief but colorful run of B-movie action pictures, wanted Sean to play the Green Knight in a period piece called Sword of the Valiant. For 6 days of work, that would amount to 12 minutes on screen, I set Sean's price at $1 million, plus a penalty of $250,000 per day if he was kept past the first week. No actor had earned so much for so little. Better yet, because the shoot was in France, Sean wouldn't pay any taxes. The producers balked, then, hours later, caved. They needed the Connery brand to sell the film. Going into Sword of the Valiant, I told Sean, just show up and take the money. Don't try to be the producer and the cinematographer and the makeup guy. Have some fun for a change. 2 days into the shoot, I visited him in Avignon. We went to dinner and I said, so how does it feel to be doing nothing? Sean spared no detail on what needed to be fixed. As my jet lag caught up to me, I began nodding off. You young guys have no stamina, Sean said, reprovingly. He himself was tireless. He'd disembark in Los Angeles after a 9-hour time change and scoot off to play a couple of sets of tennis. He remained extremely attractive. At restaurants, even with his hairpiece at home, women of all ages still gave him the take-me-now look. In 1989, when Sean was 59, People magazine would declare him the sexiest man alive, but he had entered the phase where leading men needed to downshift to more mature roles. I knew he'd fight me on that. My lever was The Untouchables, a Brian De Palma film starring Kevin Costner as Elliot Ness. It had an exceptional part for Sean, an Irish cop who was Ness's stern but avuncular mentor. Sean could steal every scene. You're the eminence grise in this movie, I said. But I'm not the lead, Sean said, and I die midway through. His character got gunned down by Al Capone's mob. That's the key scene. You give Costner the strength to go on against Capone. But I'm still dead. He just did not want to play the older mentor. After weeks of this, I appealed to Micheline. At first, she took Sean's side, but when I explained why the job would position Sean for the next decade, she gently brought her husband around. I called Sean again and said, Sean, you have to play this role, and with no hairpiece, it's time. You have to risk alienating your clients. When you tell someone the truth, all they can do is get upset. They can't call you an idiot. Sean finally gave in. We were good until the first day of shooting, when the predictable complaints began. His character, Jim Malone, was made up to be in his 60s, and Sean loathed his shapeless period suit and tweed cap. But he liked Costner and De Palma, and he gradually, grudgingly, came to embrace the role, and he did steal every scene. The Untouchables earned Sean his only Oscar, and it set up a distinguished late-career run. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, The Hunt for Red October, The Russia House, The Rock. He didn't want to play an even older Russian in The Hunt for Red October, but I firmly said, Sean, you're going to look great in a blue uniform. He wasn't the type to gush, but never was a client more faithful and appreciative. He became my friend and advisor, an honorary member of the Ovitz clan. He vented when something went terribly wrong, like the time I packaged him with Sidney Lumet and Dustin Hoffman in Family Business, one of the best-sounding, worst-executed movie ideas ever. But it was like fighting with family. Sean never threatened to leave us. On his 60th birthday in 1990, Micheline and I threw him a surprise party at Wolfgang Puck's brewery restaurant in West Los Angeles. The 200 guests were all people he had worked with or was close to or greatly respected, including Clint Eastwood, Michael Caine, Michelle Pfeiffer, Harrison Ford, and Steven Spielberg. As we walked Sean in, I could see that he was moved, and that moved me. When he stood on a riser to speak, he cried and couldn't say a word. Chapter 6. Car phones. If a lawyer did a favor for us, we tried to do a bigger one for them. In the business of favors, the chits add up. Not long after Gary Hendler introduced me to Sean Connery, I found a way to repay him. I knew that Gary was badly overworked and that Barry Hirsch was restless at his firm. They embodied two of the city's top three entertainment law firms. So why not package Hendler and Hirsch? I took Gary to dinner and sang Barry's praises. On my way home, I called Barry from my car and asked him to breakfast the next morning in Santa Monica. I pitched him on Gary, and the two of them met the following day. Less than a week later, Barry and Gary formed Armstrong, Hendler, and Hirsch, a hub of motion picture talent. CAA would represent 50 of their clients within a year. Then Sylvester Stallone told Ron Meyer he planned to fire his lawyer, Jake Blum, who had brought Sly to us in the first place. Ron had a tough conversation with his star, and Sly agreed to sit tight. That meant something around town. It showed the lawyers that we valued them and that they were better off on our side. Burt Fields was my channel to Dustin Hoffman. Burt was a litigator nonpareil. Whenever there was a big Hollywood lawsuit, both sides would race to engage him. I met Burt when we were starting CAA, and after our first lunch, I sent him a check for $5 to retain his services, a mostly jocular way to give him a conflict to think about if anyone asked him to sue us. Dustin, having broken out in The Graduate in 1967, had lost his way, as well as his first marriage, to the intoxications of celebrity. Then an old family friend, a businesswoman named Lisa Gottsagen, came into his life. Lisa kept Dustin on the straight and narrow and made sure he read the scripts he got sent. They were engaged to be married in 1979 when Judy and I met them for dinner at Chasen's, the West Hollywood institution where Frank Sinatra and Gregory Peck kept red leather booths on reserve. Dustin had just shot Kramer vs. Kramer, which would win him his first Oscar, but prior to that he'd had a string of bombs and his career was in a precarious place. He was extremely picky about roles, the opposite of Sean Connery, but my pitch was much the same. "We'll make sure you see everything," I said. I tried to turn a weakness, my inexperience and dearth of film clients, into a strength. He'd have my complete attention. I could tell I was scoring points with Lisa. She'd grown up near me in the valley, and I felt instantly comfortable with her, but Dustin was harder to read. On impulse, I said, "Try us out, and I won't charge you anything until you think I've earned it." It was the only time I ever offered to take less than 10%, much less work for free. If word of the arrangement got out, the haggling with other clients would never end, but we desperately needed a top-10 film star like Dustin Hoffman. I deluged him with material and signed him 6 months later. While Sean and Dustin were coups for CAA, we still needed directors. I'd long loitered near one of the best, Sidney Pollack. During my time at William Morris, Sidney was making standout pictures like They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And Jeremiah Johnson. I'd stumbled across him on the streets of New York in 1972 while he was filming The Way We Were and watched behind the rope with the other passers-by. Sidney handled Robert Redford and Barbra Streisand so lightly that they didn't even notice the bridle. The famously skittish Streisand seemed to trust him completely. As I watched them, a vision of the future came over me. I'm going to have all of these people someday in an agency that will represent the whole food chain and flip the power from the studios to the artists. Even then, I had the odd feeling that Sidney would be my master key. Realizing that vision took years. When I heard about The Yakuza, a film about the Japanese crime syndicate that Sidney would release in 1975, I cold-called him and offered to connect him to Ed Parker, a local martial artist who could choreograph the movie. Ed didn't get the job, but I kept in touch and stopped by Sidney's office every so often. I stayed after him when we started CAA, escalating my soft pressure a notch in 1977 after Sidney invited me to the premiere for Bobby Deerfield. Al Pacino was outstanding as the hard-hearted race car driver, but the movie never really gelled. Because Sidney had yet to make a blockbuster, he was ripe to be lured. Sidney's longtime agent was Evart Ziegler, a cultured, white-haired Princeton man, a literary agent out of Central Casting. Zieg went his own way, living in far-off Pasadena, even as his firm, Ziegler, Diskant, and Roth, represented A-list writers like William Goldman, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and Willard and Gloria Hike, Star Wars. He also had top-tier directors like Dick Donner, Superman, and Jim Bridges, Urban Cowboy. I wanted them all, but how to lure them away? The unexpected answer came through my car telephone, a novelty at the time. The radio-based phone, slightly larger than a shoebox, had 11 channels. You kept pushing buttons until you found a dial tone. Busy channels were like party lines. Any subscriber could listen in. On my way to the office one morning, I heard a voice that sounded like Evart Ziegler's. I pulled off the road to take notes because Zieg was discussing his star-studded list with his assistant. I clocked in at the same time the next morning, and there was Zieg again doing business while commuting. He sounded old and forlorn. Zieg was past 60, and at a time when we were swarming potential clients, he had just one assistant and a junior partner named Steve Roth. I decided to try to buy him out. To make him more receptive, to soften him up, I escalated my campaign to sign Sidney Pollack. "I'll kill for you," I told Sidney. All I had to sell was my passion and energy and the fact that I was 30 years younger than Evart Ziegler. As Sidney wavered, we got screenplay after screenplay into his hands before Zieg did. I pestered Mort Janklow for drafts of upcoming books and sent out summaries by the dozen. Each day, I spent up to 2 hours on Sidney, far more than anyone would spend for his biggest signed client. Sidney was Hamlet reincarnated. He never made a fast decision, but in 1981, with our courtship in its second year, he signed with me at last. Having dealt Zieg a body blow, we offered him $750,000 for his agency, plus a lifetime royalty on his client's work. He'd keep a piece of his business in perpetuity, even if he never came to the office. After we'd negotiated for 6 months, Zieg passed. Either he doubted our staying power or he couldn't stomach surrendering to some whippersnappers. But during our discussions, we discovered that Steve Roth serviced the cream of their younger clientele and that Steve was eager to leave. We promptly cut a deal for him to come to CAA. That got us most of what we wanted, including Dick Donner, Jim Bridges, and the Hikes, at the price of Steve's compensation, $250,000 a year, and the potential to become a partner. We had to build a critical mass of clients so we could reverse the power curve from the buyers, the studios, to the sellers, us, and anyone in our way was going to get rolled over. With his core business gone, Zieg sold what remained to ICM in 1983, and he was done. The truth is that I didn't give a thought to Zieg after he turned us down. You never heard that someone was unhappy afterward, they just lost. Ron sometimes had to remind me not to roll over everyone. Jack Nicholson was with a one-man outfit, Sandy Bressler, so we wouldn't go after Jack. There are 200 of these smaller agencies, Ron would say, and you can't put them all out of business. That made sense to me, even then. But flattening Evart Ziegler was the beginning of my Sherman-esque march to the sea. Steve Roth, our new hire, had grown up in Beverly Hills and knew how to handle himself around celebrities. He was glib and well-dressed and unflappable. We offered him a full partnership after a make-good period. He started out guns blazing, but soon he was skipping the Saturday meetings. Then he started coming in late on weekdays. Steve was hanging out with producers like Frank Yablans and Robert Evans, people who blew off phone calls as a prerogative of power, and he started behaving like them. Matters came to a head in a conference call with Dick Donner. Dick had used me as a sounding board since Superman. Now, as he was transitioning between Zig and CAA, he had asked us for comments on Inside Moves, an original screenplay by Barry Levinson and Valerie Curtin. As Dick and Steve and I talked through the script, I realized that something was off. Steve was parroting whatever Dick said. 45 minutes in, Dick asked, "What do you guys think about the scene where the nun gets raped on top of the bar? I'm worried it breaks the tone of the movie." There was no such scene in Inside Moves. No nun at all, in fact. Before I could jump in, Steve said, "Dick, I agree with you 100%. Dick Donner, a total sweetheart, hung up and then took his phone off the hook. We couldn't reach him for 2 days. Steve Roth, it turned out, did not really like to read, or for that matter, work. He began to remind Ron and me of the rich brats in the Morris mailroom. I went to Frank Price, Columbia's chairman and CEO, for a favor, as we had a couple of pictures in the pipeline with him, including Tootsie and Stripes. 1 week later, Steve moved to the Columbia lot to begin work on his new production deal. We didn't usually fire people at CAA, but we did ease them out and into positions where they could help us. The time I put in wooing Sidney Pollack was the best investment I ever made. He became my friend, my mentor, and my calling card. 2 weeks after I signed him, we bought another red ad in Variety and The Hollywood Reporter for Robert Redford, as big a star as there was. The entertainment business was an infrared system. When you got hot, people gravitated toward your heat, which made you hotter. Along with Sean and Dustin, landing Sidney and Bob vaulted CAA into contender status with ICM and William Morris. In 1979, when I moved full-time into film, television accounted for 90% of the agency's revenue. By 1982, 60% of our business was in film. We rapidly became players where it counted most. Ron Meyer began calling me Rumpelstiltskin. "There goes Rumpelstiltskin," he'd say, "turning shit into gold." In the original fable, it was straw, but like any great agent, Ron improved things in the telling. In dealing with the studios, Ron and I developed an effective 1-2 punch. After I opened with a hard line, asking for an amount somewhere between more than we expected to get and ridiculous, execs would back-channel Ron and say, "My God, he asked for $6 million for Warren Beatty against 10 of the gross?" meaning 10%. "Can you help us out?" Ron would smooth their feathers and say, "I'll talk to him," or "try this." After they called me back, I'd tell Ron where things stood for the next round. On occasion, I would offer a small concession. More often, I'd hold firm and close the deal where I started, but the buyers always felt better because they'd been listened to. They never seemed to get that Ron was my agent. Yet, there wasn't a day when I didn't walk in the door and get hit by a rush of anxiety. What idea can I come up with today to pay the overhead? There'd be the adrenaline rush when we sent out the internal memo, "Robert Redford is now a client." 15 minutes later, it was, "What next?" In 1979, when I was 33, Ted Ashley at Warner Brothers took me aside and said, "I'm going to give you some great advice." He grinned ruefully. "And knowing you, you're not going to take it, but here it is. I could have worked 10% less, and it wouldn't have made a difference in my professional success, but I would have been a lot happier." Ted was absolutely right on both counts. It was great advice, and I didn't take it. I see now that I could have worked as much as 20% less, and it wouldn't have cost me. If I'd worked even 10% less across 30 years, that's 3 whole extra years of life I'd have enjoyed. On the other hand, Ted himself stepped down from Warner Brothers at a relatively young age, in his late 50s, and when I saw him a few years later, I was stunned by how listless he seemed. I had no interest in retiring young after mid-level success. The same year that Ted gave me the advice on slowing down, he put me in a room with Steve Ross, CEO of Warner Brothers in New York. Steve was a visionary. He was tough, forceful, generous, and impossibly charming. Hard as nails, yet widely liked. starting with a few parking lots he had bought and sold his way to the very top of the media and entertainment industries. Ted wanted me to come to Warner, and I was flattered, but only 5 years into CAA, I knew I wasn't ready for a studio position. "I'm really not that interested," I told Steve. "Well, what job are you interested in?" he asked. "Yours. I want to learn everything I can, and then someday I'd like to have your job." He laughed. "That's the answer I was hoping for," he said. Instead of feeling threatened or offended, he found my ambition refreshing, the sign of a true leader. I took note of that quality and tried to mirror Steve's best aspects at CAA. It was hard to feel as relaxed as Steve seemed, though. Even when I'd visit an art gallery and find myself blessedly unreachable, in those days before cell phones, I'd feel a stabbing anxiety in my gut because I knew 25 people were trying to reach me. Your clients burn through your energy, your expertise, your joy. For every Dusty Hoffman with a wife and 5 great kids, there are 100 more who have only an all-consuming need for attention. If you're that kind of emotional gypsy, then the Sunday brunches at the Scientology building begin to look pretty good. When Ron and I were in New York one weekend in 1979, I suggested we take a walk in Central Park. I told him, softly but firmly, that the ownership structure of our company was way off. Roland wasn't bringing in any income, and Mike, who'd always hoped that CAA would be a boutique agency, was clearly sidling toward the exit. I said that if I didn't get more than the 16.67% that each of the 6 partners owned, I'd have to consider other options. I knew Ron wouldn't want to jeopardize what we'd built. He often acted as my agent with the others, breaking tough news to them, or from them to me. He enjoyed being the Ovitz whisperer, so I was confident he'd deliver on my ask. And, indeed, when he spoke with the others, they took the obvious point that I had clearly become the firm's leader. I replaced Roland as the firm's president and got a larger allocation of shares. In 1982, Mike would retire, and we'd buy out his shares for $750,000. Professionally, mission accomplished. Emotionally, though, I had just hit the self-destruct button. Only it would take 16 years to go off. Bill Haber never forgave me. He would later say, "Agreeing to give to Michael some of my own shares is the only professional regret I have in my life." Even worse, I never suggested to Ron that his stake also be increased. I wasn't emotionally aware enough to realize that he'd feel slighted if I moved up, and he didn't. Ron wanted Bill's shares, and he wanted him gone. The problem was that Bill was a magnificent head of television. Like Howard West, he could look at a raw idea and turn it into a TV show. He gave better notes on scripts than many a producer or network exec, but Bill wasn't good with younger agents. He was always giving them pop quizzes, asking, "What show has an opening for such and such director?" And even in the early days, he'd take long weekends. Later, they would turn into long weekends at his Paris home or his chateau in the Loire Valley. What's more, several times a year, some minor issue would make him send us an overwrought letter of resignation, announcing that he was going to go work with blind children or help save the bats from extinction. Bill just wanted to be heard and respected, to be courted a little, but Ron yearned to call his bluff. We had poached Lee Gabler from ICM to be Bill's number 2 in case Bill made good on his next threat to leave. Ron looked at Lee and saw Bill's replacement, but I didn't want to mess with our success. I wanted everything to stay the same, except that I'd get more. What I should have done for Ron was give him some of my own allocation of shares and then figure out how to handle Bill. To really be his blood brother, I should have behaved as his agent. Bill never had an inkling of Ron's animus. I was amazed at how well Ron hid his true feelings from someone he saw every day. Chapter 7. The Second Valley. CAA had 4 commandments. 1, never lie to your clients or colleagues. 2, return every call by end of day, or at least have your assistant buy you a day's grace. 3, follow up and don't leave people guessing. Every desk phone at CAA bore the message, "Communicate." After our Fred Spector heard me use that word in every speech I gave, he stuck the plaques on Ron's phone and mine, and when we admired them, he stuck them on everyone's phone. It was our version of IBM's famous imperative to think. The last commandment, and the hardest one to follow, was 4, never badmouth the competition. Gossip was a tool of the trade. Other agencies routinely disparaged soon-to-be-released films by directors they hoped to sign. The performances stink, the studio's pulling back on publicity, it won't make a dime. The worse the buzz, and the weaker the box office, the more open a director might be to changing representation. But if you are confident about your own work, why snipe? Why tear down someone you're hoping to be in business with? We built our company around positive thinking. We had no hierarchy, no titles, no reporting lines, no nameplates. We killed ourselves to take everyone's point of view in meetings, to make everyone feel empowered. CAA had no formal business hours. If the partners' cars were in the garage at 8 o'clock in the morning, so were everybody else's. When I made my evening rounds at 7 o'clock, 80% of our people were at their desks. The work was the thing. We even had a no-fly-by-day rule. If you flew to New York, you took the red eye so you didn't waste a work day in the air. Ron and I would park our cars in the number one and number two spots and leave them there when we walked to business dinners before coming back to retrieve them. We worked insanely hard, but we fostered the illusion of working impossibly hard. I believed momentum was everything. Once a company relaxed, it was done for. The lack of hierarchy was a myth, of course, a management tool. Nothing happened that Ron and Bill and I didn't want to have happen. We were democratic dictators. I thought of creating our corporate culture as akin to making a giant pointillist painting, dabbing in a million dots that, when you stood back, came into focus as a coherent picture. Each dot was a detail. For instance, we took great pains in our hiring. Everyone we brought on had been interviewed by the whole company first, so we had across-the-board buy-in, and I wrote memos to everyone about everything. The advantages of Pan Am over Continental for flights to New York, the imperative need to look for any post-1900 female biographical characters that have not been covered in the media for our client Sally Field to play, specifications for the cake for Marty Scorsese's 50th birthday party. Marty likes chocolate and is not averse to coconut. Even how to get Zigna suits at cost plus $200 so we'd all look sharp. If you're interested, I will set up an appointment for my oldest friend Steve Stearns to come into the office with all of the fabrics for the fall line. If you are not interested, I do not care. Sending out 10 or more such memos every day, getting every detail just so, was extraordinarily time-consuming, but time was our nest egg. Our corporate culture was American team sports boosterism mixed with Spartan military tactics mixed with Asian philosophy, all overlaid by the communitarian spirit of the Three Musketeers. That culture was a collective endeavor, and one that hundreds of people shaped and defined over the years. But among the partners, I gave the most thought to what it should be. I scraped from an eclectic variety of sources, a businessman's version of Picasso's method. From law firms, I took our phraseology. Ron was a partner, and so were the people in the mailroom. And also the paramount importance of confidentiality. Our collaborative approach came from the way Magic Johnson ran his fast break with the Lakers. He'd drive it up the middle, have an open shot, and pass it up to feed an unguarded teammate. Who wouldn't kill to play with that point guard? At staff meetings and retreats, I began to talk about the philosophy of the Chinese general and military strategist Sun Tzu, whose The Art of War I'd read in college. We took his ideas on loyalty, on teamwork, and on how having complete information was the key to decision-making. The book also resonated with me because it prioritized strength and toughness. Ron and Bill thought my emphasis on Sun Tzu was crazy until they realized that it worked, that our team bought in. In truth, though, the Chinese general was always a bit of a prop. It wasn't so much what he said that inspired CAA as the idea that we, a 5-year-old company, were adhering to a philosophy from 2,500 years earlier. It gave us instant roots. I was obsessed with the Spartan phalanx, the idea that you are only as strong as the colleague on your left. We'd go to meetings as a group, we'd go to screenings as a group, walking down the aisles together half an hour early, 10 or 15 strong, a show of power. I drove our people hard to sign at least 2 clients a week, and after we got up and running, our signing machinery was a thing of beauty. Let's say you were a promising screenwriter and I met you at a dinner at Morton's. I'd call you the next day for a quick chat, not about wanting to represent you, but about the virtues of your work, which 3 of our literary agents would have briefed me on. I'd casually toss in the names of a few well-known actors and directors who'd be a perfect fit with your sensibility. 99% of the time, you'd want to talk some more, and I'd suggest lunch or a drink. There we'd talk further about your work and your hopes and dreams. The killer move, as you got up from the table or were handing your parking ticket to the valet, was to say, "Why don't you come in and meet our crew?" A few days later, when you drove in, one of our parking concierges, who'd been given a photo of you, would open your car door, greet you with a big smile, and say, "Mr. and Ms. X, great to see you. Really hope you join the family," or "Hope you have a great meeting." They switched up the pattern to keep from going stale. An assistant would escort you to the conference room where 5 to 10 poised, well-dressed agents would be waiting. They'd already have had a pre-meeting to script the ideas we'd be presenting, and now, for an hour, they'd pepper you with notions for developing your books and screenplays and shower you with the names of our clients who were eager to be in your films. At the end, we'd finally say, "We want to represent you." It was hard to resist. If you raised a serious issue, "I'd love to, guys, but I just signed with ICM for 2 years," we'd always say, "Not a problem. We'll deal with it." We'd let ICM commission you for those 2 years as we packaged your work with our other clients, playing the long game. Clients would often have 5 of our agents in their lives. Robert Redford, for instance, had Tina Nides as his literary agent, Sandy Kleiman providing strategy, David O'Connor as his daily point person, Jay Maloney routinely involved as my assistant, and me available when necessary. Usually clients would gradually gravitate to one agent for most conversations, though if that relationship soured, we had multiple backups ready to step in. Our point of differentiation was that a client got regular phone calls from not one but several agents, all coordinated among the client's team with the interoffice memos we called buck slips. You just can't beat 5 with 1. All of our agents really did represent all of our clients. Of course, this sometimes led to individual CAA agents feeling individually responsible for a given client's success and claiming solo credit later. That wasn't how it was supposed to work, but it was an uptown problem. We told our agents that they were never not on stage, 7 days and 7 nights a week. There was no explicit dress code, but you knew you had to dress the way we did and keep your private life as well as your business private. When we hired Rick Nocita from William Morris, he asked if he had to wear a suit. In those days, you'd see other agencies' agents wearing corduroy blazers and even an occasional suede elbow patch. "You don't have to do anything you don't want to do," I said evenly. Rick showed up in a suit. Only the music division dressed down. Formality didn't play with their artists. We had group meetings every day, and sometimes twice a day, to ensure that we were all on song. I also did rounds twice a day, like a doctor, carrying a sheaf of papers so it looked like I was going into a meeting, when actually I was gauging the general mood and taking note of anyone who seemed out of sorts. I viewed our people as my children, and for the first 10 years, I'd call every employee who didn't show up at work to make sure they were okay, and to see if they needed anything, from chicken soup to a good divorce lawyer. I did it out of concern, but I also wanted them to know I was keeping a watchful eye. Our idea was to make everyone feel that our building was a comfort zone, and to balance that with a little anxiety should they step outside the building. We wanted the "don't cross those guys" message to be as obvious as a flashing sign at the border. Yet our MO was to be attentive, polite, and well-informed. I wanted worldliness to be one of a CAA agent's defining qualities. Be able to talk knowledgeably about what your clients love. This will encompass pretty much everything. I insisted that our agents have a reading list, one national newspaper, one international news magazine, and one special interest magazine, such as Golf Digest. I had 200 magazine subscriptions, and I'd skim the magazines as I was on the phone, everything from Redbook to Road and Track. I got a lot of flack about all this homework, but I remember feeling vindicated when Mike Menchel, a 26-year-old agent, came with me to Aspen for the opening of a play Robin Williams was in. Mike walked up to Jack Nicholson and offered him a light, then chatted with him about golf and the Lakers, two of Jack's favorite topics. I told our staff we should know about every news story days or weeks before it was in Variety. The trick was to find the hidden motherlodes of information, and to do that we had to exploit a niche the rest had overlooked. Ron and Bill and I began by handling studio executives' own employment contracts, as we'd long done for TV execs. We took no fees for this. We were after something more valuable, an inside track. The vice presidents we handled would give us tips and take a second look at our clients. Then we shared those tips with the most powerful people in town. In the pre-email era, when people were flooded by phone messages, which calls did they return first? CAAs, on the chance they might learn something useful. Soon, we represented so many executives that we could see the entire chessboard. The instant we sensed someone was unhappy, we'd be thinking about where to move them, and whom to move into their place. We knew about openings before the executives themselves did. That's how we helped move Les Moonves from Warner to run CBS, Brandon Tartikoff from NBC to Paramount, and Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner from ABC to their own production company, with a CAA-brokered guarantee for several pilots from their former employer. I would often tell our agents to watch a space. In 30 to 60 days, something big will happen at Paramount. If I was quietly settling Frank Mancuso's dispute with Marty Davis about his severance pay, and Variety ran a story that Frank was going to sue Marty, I'd say, don't count on it. I enjoyed seeming all-knowing, the Great Oz, but the real point was to signal our agents that we were working at a level above their heads, that if they were planning to leave for a studio job, for instance, we'd know before they'd even discussed their contract. We drilled into everyone that they were rewarded by how the company did and how they worked with their associates. The weakest link broke the chain. Being human and fallible broke the chain. It was a tough business. Freddie Fields and the producer Ray Stark were tough sons of bitches, and you had to be just as tough or tougher to earn their respect. So I aimed for us to seem formidable. Regrettably, we overshot the mark and became fearsome. Judy and I put off having children while we built CAA. I was 33 in 1980 when Chris, our firstborn, arrived at Cedars-Sinai. As I giddily counted fingers and toes, my priorities changed forever. Before Chris, I thought only of work. After Chris came along, followed by Kimberly in 1983 and Eric in 1986, I still worked weekends, but I strove to carve out regular family time. I wanted us to raise our children the way my parents had raised Mark and me, with stable routines and rituals, and without the live-in grandmother. The big deals in Encino were Little League, backyard barbecues at sundown, and street ball with my father and my friends. How could we replicate that experience in Brentwood, with kids who grew up around limos and private planes, and with a father who was overbooked before he woke up? I didn't want them to feel entitled or neglected. After considerable trial and error, Judy and I came up with a system that seemed to work, more or less. On weekdays, we'd do whatever CAA required, my lunatic daily scheduling, our evening entertaining, but on weekends, we'd revert to the 50s with consistent parental involvement. Save for an award show or a formal dinner, we took Chris with us in his baby basket wherever we went. He traveled to Europe and Hawaii before his first birthday, and so did Kim and Eric before theirs. The problem with this throwback arrangement was that Judy ended up being largely responsible for raising the kids. She became the one in charge of feelings and emotions of daily life, and I was left as the planner, scripting where we should all be going. I repeatedly told our kids that I didn't want them going into entertainment. For one thing, I didn't think they'd get a fair shake, given the overhang of my reputation. For another, I privately worried that they'd never achieve as much as I had. The kids of agents who followed them into the business never seemed to live up to their father's reputations. Each of our kids reacted to my growing public profile differently. Chris had Judy's sensitivity and my fire. An excellent baseball player at John Thomas Dye, he expressed himself physically. I remember feeling stunned when I saw him hit a ball out of the schoolyard in sixth grade. Where did he get such easy power? But when his classmates made cracks about CAA or my success, parroting their parents, Chris would start throwing punches. That same sixth grade year, his best friend's father and I got called into the school because our sons had gotten into a fight with some kids who'd pushed them down. The vice principal told us that the school didn't tolerate violence. I said, "We agree, but what if someone is aggressive toward you first?" Calmly and methodically, point by point, we turned the discussion around until the vice principal let the matter drop. I thought, at the time, that I'd done a great job for my son. When Chris was 15, I took him out for sushi to a little hole-in-the-wall place we like called Asakuma. I was lecturing him about art, trying to interest him in it, and he was obviously just humoring me. Growing nettled, I said, "You know, your dad and his agency represent Michael Jackson and Madonna and Bill Murray and the Smashing Pumpkins. Your dad is actually kind of cool." He looked up from his miso soup, smiling a little, and said, "Yeah, Dad, I got it." We both laughed. I was selling my son on me, selling him on the idea that I was contemporary and hip and that I knew exactly what he was thinking, which was totally untrue. I was furious when Chris transferred his sophomore year from Brown University to UCLA, where his girlfriend was. My dream was that he'd get the Ivy League education I never did. He didn't have a dream. He had a girlfriend. I begged him not to go to UCLA, then I begged him not to go to film school afterward, then I begged him not to go to business school, then I begged him not to take a job as an exec at Paramount, the entertainment business, after all my warnings. I lost every argument. He had inherited my hard-headedness. Kim was the most like me, inquisitive and no-nonsense and highly opinionated, except that she was female and an excellent horseback rider. She was entranced by fashion from an early age. When she was 9, we found tear sheets from all the women's magazines buried in her closet, alongside her sketches for her own clothing line. She turned her back on all the entertainment world hoopla, the movie stars over for dinner. When she was at NYU, later, she walked into the dorm one day and the security guard said, "Hey, did you see your dad was in the paper again?" A reference to a front-page New York Times story about CAA and our work for MGM. Kim didn't say a word, but that afternoon she applied to transfer to Brown. She needed to find her own way, a trait I recognized and admired, even as it left me feeling forlorn. Was I driving her away? When she was at Brown, I came to the campus to interview Martin Scorsese about creativity, and afterward, at a table with the school's trustees, I did what I always do. Asked questions of everyone, getting them talking about themselves so they'd give me a clue or two that would enable me to pretend I knew of them, even if I hadn't the faintest idea who they were. Kim, who was at my table, watched these exchanges carefully. Afterward, she told me, "That was a great lesson, how you made everyone feel comfortable and important while you were learning everything you needed." Eric, our youngest, required the least maintenance. He used verbal judo to deflect any reference to what I did and always seemed warm and self-confident. He had a quiet forcefulness, but he hated his school, Harvard Westlake, and in 10th grade he came to me and insisted that we visit some boarding schools in the East, far, far away. He ended up at a school in Connecticut and then at Northwestern University. He never liked CAA or the powerful warping force field of the entertainment world and was much happier thousands of miles from it. Where I always worked hard to seem unruffled by life, Eric was genuinely unruffled by it. I admired that about him. How did he end up so relaxed? My kids all turned out well, but looking back, I can see that my occasional impulse to treat them as clients was a really dumb idea. It was almost impossible for me to turn off my agenting impulses. Here are your strengths, but here's what you could do better. Come here with me, meet these people, and that will set you up to do X and Y. I worked on my clients during the week, and my kids on the weekend. We decided that another royal road to talent lay through comedy. The focus of our efforts was Saturday Night Live, where producer Lorne Michaels had assembled the crackerjack not ready for primetime players, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Gilda Radner, and, in season two, Bill Murray. After the show's debut in 1975, its stars became the Beatles of television. They could lift CAA to a new level if we could sign them. Unfortunately, a manager-producer named Bernie Brillstein represented Lorne and had dibs on most of the show's cast, including Aykroyd and Belushi. Chevy Chase, SNL's first breakout star, had his own manager and agent. Bill Murray, a free spirit, had no one, but we didn't yet represent anyone he trusted who'd vouch for us. So we stayed patient, waiting. In June 1979, Michael Eisner invited me to a Paramount screening of Meatballs, a low-budget summer camp farce with Bill Murray in his first lead role. The director was a Canadian named Ivan Reitman. Meatballs was the funniest thing I'd seen since Animal House, the fraternity farce Ivan had produced the year before. I introduced myself to Ivan and set a meeting through his lawyer, Tom Pollock. Ivan was a very desirable commercial talent. Animal House and Meatballs earned their budgets back 30 times over because he knew what audiences wanted. At our meeting, though, he immediately asked, "What can you do that I can't do for myself? I find my own material, and I don't need anybody to get me work. All my talk of strategy and positioning, all my promises of synergies with our team and other clients, seem to fall on deaf ears." Afterward, I told Tom, "Too bad, but thanks anyway." Tom said, "Ivan really liked you." "Right. No, really." It turned out that Ivan was as good as I was at keeping his feelings hidden. After CAA signed him, we had someone to vouch for us with Bill Murray. Ron, our best closer, met with Bill in New York, but for some reason, they didn't click. Bill was one of the few who remained uncharmed, unseduced. "We just kept walking around," Ron told me. "Why don't you take a shot?" On my next trip to New York, I called Bill and said, "Where would you like to meet?" He said, "Grant's Tomb at 11 o'clock, and hung up. It took me two cabbies to get dropped near a pillared mausoleum in Riverside Park. Bill was waiting there. Without saying much, he took off walking, destination unknown. I tagged along. It was clear he didn't want to be sold, he just wanted to see what I was like. So for 7 hours, we hiked through the city with breaks for lunch and dinner. We talked about the Yankees and Bill's hometown football team, the Bears, about children and humor and life. As Bill was assessing me, I was assessing him and realizing that his fans had misread him. He didn't want to be a comedian. He wanted to be a great actor. Left to his own devices, he might have stuck to character roles in small, quirky films. He was a free spirit who tried to make daily life into a movie scene, with the crucial difference that there was no script, so anything could happen. That afternoon, he ordered a cup of coffee at a diner and said, "Good party." Totally deadpan, and the server cracked up. Even crossing the street became an exercise in improv theater. I was hardly Mr. Spontaneity, but I really warmed to Bill's random acts of curiosity, and for some reason, he warmed to me, even after we started talking business about 6 hours in. Of all my clients, I was always most comfortable with the people in comedy, starting with Barry Levinson and continuing with Robin Williams, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and David Letterman. Perhaps it was because, like me, they were totally self-made and lived entirely by their wits. And of all of them, I was the most deeply, instantly comfortable with Bill Murray. He was extremely bright, startlingly well-read, remarkably easy to talk to, and genuinely sympathetic. I knew that commercial would be a dirty word to Bill, but I told him it was also a magic word. "Look," I said, "you need a couple of heavy-duty commercial movies first to establish yourself in the marketplace, and then you can make anything you want." We followed that plan for 15 years, setting up hits like Stripes and Ghostbusters and Groundhog Day, while allowing Bill time to make personal films like Mad Dog and Glory. Sometimes we knocked heads. The Razor's Edge, based on Bill's favorite Somerset Maugham novel, had to be rammed down Columbia's throat. It was a complete downer, and I believe Bill's fans would be nonplussed. Bill was too young to be doing brilliant but esoteric work. There was plenty of time for him to get there, transitioning his audience slowly, but there comes a point where an agent must bow to a client's wishes, if he wants to remain that client's agent. Ron told me I'd fallen in love with Bill, and he was right. Over the years, I helped talk Bill through two divorces, but he also became one of the very few clients I could unload my problems on. We usually hung out in Manhattan, meeting at a spot he chose at the last minute. Because he didn't like driving, we'd walk, me in a suit and Bill in some outfit like plaid shorts and a purple shirt. We'd stop at two or three restaurants for a drink so he could gauge the vibe before he chose one and settled in. He knew every doorman and maitre d' by name, and tables always materialized. Once we joined a five-deep crowd outside a tiny place on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. Bill flagged down the owner and ordered wine for everyone waiting on the sidewalk. By the time they squeezed a table for us into the middle of the restaurant, people were having too much fun to care that we'd cut the line. Around this time, my son Chris, who was six, exhibited some worrisome neurological symptoms, and I took him to a specialist at Yale for tests. I was feeling anxious and low when Bill surprised me by showing up at my ratty New Haven hotel. He stayed for 2 days until the worst was ruled out. His compassion didn't stop with his friends. He passed out tens and twenties to homeless people as we walked and often knew their names, but he was nobody's patsy. On the Upper West Side once, after we passed a man with a cup, Bill turned to yell, Don't you fucking try to steal money from people who need it. The man said, I'm sorry, Mr. Murray, I'm really sorry. A few yards on, I asked, what was that about? He had $200 sneakers and a clean cup, and he's panhandling. I won't tolerate that. There are too many people on the street who really need it. When I signed him, Bill was at work on Where the Buffalo Roam, a film about the gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson, who'd written Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. After one of my late planes to New York, I headed to the Sherry Netherland and downed 2 sleepies and a shot of scotch. I hadn't slept the night before and was soon dead to the world until I popped awake, heart pounding. The clock said 2 a.m., and my room door was open. 2 men were silhouetted in the doorway. A jauntily familiar voice said, how you doing? With charm and a $20 bill, Bill had cajoled an attendant into unlocking my door. Let's go, he said. I pulled on my clothes and staggered out with Bill and his companion, a thin, balding guy in his mid-40s. I registered his pasty complexion and the sunglasses, which not many people wore indoors in the middle of the night. Hunter S. Thompson. As we bar-hopped through Lower Manhattan, Hunter downed a prodigious amount of booze, expounded on contemporary literature and deer hunting, and proved to be bleakly funny, unremittingly intense, and deeply insane. The sun was up when I stumbled back to my hotel to shower, shave, and prep for my 8 a.m. meeting. By then, I'd grown close to Ivan Reitman. When Ivan pitched Cheech and Chong join the army to Paramount, Michael Eisner couldn't stop gushing. Ivan believed he had a guarantee to produce and direct 3 movies, but in a subsequent meeting, I realized that Michael was reneging. He indicated that Barry Diller had overruled him. The studio was now offering a basic development deal with no obligation beyond Ivan's first film. Ivan at my side, I marched from Michael's office to a payphone in the Paramount parking lot and called Frank Price at Columbia. A former television writer, Frank was the rare studio chief who could read a screenplay and give you surgical notes to improve it. He brought TV-style discipline to the movie business, giving you a prompt yes or no. Within 5 minutes, Frank and I had a verbal agreement to make Ivan's army project. He also wanted the 2 other films, one of which became Ghostbusters, as soon as we had working concepts. It was a much better deal for Ivan. I immediately told Michael that I'd sold the movie to Columbia. We had to demonstrate that if you broke a promise to a CAA client, there would be consequences. For once, Eisner didn't try to guilt me. He was just rueful that Barry had countermanded him. I brought in Bill Murray to replace Cheech and Chong, and Ivan overhauled the script to reflect his new star. Bill's humor didn't need marijuana to lift off. Most of the rewriting was done by Harold Ramis, the Second City alumnus who co-wrote Meatballs and who would co-star opposite Murray in Stripes. Lead actors usually arrive on the set a week or two early to rehearse, but Bill was incommunicado until the night before shooting. He once disappeared entirely for 2 weeks before calling me collect from the Taj Mahal. When Bill finally surfaced, he had yet to meet with Ivan, and I'd lay odds he had not read the script. But he showed up in makeup the first morning, on time and ready to go. If Bill liked the concept and had faith in the director, he didn't sweat the details. He ad-libbed his way through Stripes, and the loose, shaggy movie became a hilarious hit. Frank Price had an exceptional feel for how a vague concept could become a commercial film. Another example was the Karate Kid franchise. I had met the producer Jerry Weintraub when I was 23, and he was booking Elvis Presley concerts through William Morris. Jerry's original idea was inspired by a feel-good local TV story about an 11-year-old black belt, the youngest in the country. Jerry signed the kid to a management contract and asked me to help build a movie around him. Frank liked the idea but thought the boy was too young. Make the hero a few years older, he said, and we could add a credible love interest and broaden our audience. The studio cast Ralph Macchio, then 22 and neither well-known nor physically imposing. But as high school senior Daniel LaRusso, Ralph became a bubblegum sensation. The studio made 2 sequels. Stand By Me was a dark little drama about 4 adolescent boys, including a then unknown River Phoenix, who discover a body outside their small town. Norman Lear financed the movie for director Rob Reiner, his protege since All in the Family, and they came to us after several distributors turned them down. Unless their luck changed, Norman was out $10 million and nobody would see Rob's film. Though we'd had nothing to do with Stand By Me, we felt an obligation to Rob, a CAA client, and to Norman, a good friend. We set up screenings with every studio and distributor who hadn't passed. To keep tabs, we had a mailroom trainee deliver the print and stay to see if people actually watched. His reports were revealing. The head of distribution at Fox told me he didn't much care for the movie, having slept through two-thirds of it. Another executive gabbed on the phone throughout the 89-minute runtime. As a last resort, I called Frank Price. "I know you want these big films from us," I said, "and I make sure you get first crack at them. Now, we've got a situation with one of our most important clients, and a movie we think is terrific. You have the leverage to get it out there. We need this as a straight-out favor." I pressured Frank until it strained our relationship, and he finally gave in. Columbia paid Norman his investment and approved a decent ad budget. Stand By Me went on to gross more than $50 million. It was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars and Best Picture and Best Director at the Golden Globes. Variety ran a fascinating story on why everyone else had passed. The Fox executive said he was dying to buy this marvelous movie but could not come to terms with CAA. The phone yakker said the same. "If you believe what you read in the trades, the studios never make a mistake." We were lucky to work in a golden age of commercial film. People went to the local multiplex three times a month. Piracy had yet to explode, and cable was in its infancy. With so many movies being made and with our increasing share of the talent, by the early 1980s, CAA was poised for an explosive run. We'd grown big enough to package movies with multiple clients, a common practice in television, but an uncommon one in film. Top agents like Charlie Feldman and Lou Wasserman, and later Sam Cohn, had sometimes paired a filmmaker with an actor and then checked whether a studio had something for them, but CAA was the first to orchestrate the entire development process. We took an idea, a yet-to-be-published bestseller, a magazine article, a news story, turned it into a script, and shoehorned as many artists into the project as we could. The primary difference with assembling a television show was that we didn't take a packaging fee for films we put together, just our usual commission on our clients' fees. In the beginning, we had been story-centric of necessity. Now we had our share of big names, but the material still came first. We sat with writers and floated screenplay concepts for our directors and actors, mixing and matching as we went. We had a story department, a book department, and a development department, and we held a packaging meeting every week to stay in touch with the studio's needs. Rather than pitch a 10-page treatment to a studio for $10,000, we'd tell our writers to flesh out a first draft. Then we'd attach a named director and one or more actors and sell the option for $250,000. Nothing went out unattached. If the movie got made, the writer earned $1 million for a few extra weeks' work. Meanwhile, our CAA directors were talking several times a day with their multiple CAA agents, which led organically to the directors casting more CAA actors. The process fattened our commissions and spared the studios the headaches and expensive development, though they had to pay a premium for our talent. It was win-win-win. The power of team agenting really struck me. "Hey, this is working," on The Natural, which came out in 1984. Amy Grossman, one of our literary agents, represented the screenwriter Roger Town, Robert's brother, who'd written a script based on Bernard Malamud's novel about a hard-luck baseball player. Amy had heard in one of our staff meetings that we were looking for a movie for Barry Levinson and Robert Redford to do together, so she brought the script to Rosalie Swedlin, who was on Barry's team. Then they both brought it to me on a Friday when anyone could pitch me a project. After reading it over the weekend, I immediately called Barry, had him read it, and then flew with him to Sundance to meet Bob. Within a week, both of them had committed to the film. The Natural also clarified the advantages of packaging a movie completely, down to the character actors. We already represented Bob and Barry, and Bob's co-star, Glenn Close, signed with us during the filming, but putting our clients Wilford Brimley and Kim Basinger into the film made it a different proposition. If we filled a movie with clients, and only with clients, we could present the whole package to the studios, giving them nothing to do except say yes or no. This was a crucial shift. We began to view studios as little more than banks and distribution vehicles. They'd finance the movies and get them into the theater, but the films were essentially ours. On Rain Man, a total CAA package, we even designed the marketing campaign. By shaping the package to win approval from the studio, we saved our clients from rejection anxiety. And by gathering all the conflicts we could under our roof, we'd have more knowledge, more leverage to get better salaries, and we could sort out whether a movie would be better suited to Ivan Reitman